We're excited to announce that our very own podcasting platform, Zencastr, has become a new sponsor to the show. Check out the podcast discount link in our show notes and stay tuned for why we love using Zen for the podcast.
You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
You're listening to the Archaeology Show with Chris Webster on KNVC 95.1 FM, Carson Community Media in Carson City, Nevada, and online at knvc.org/listen-live. Welcome to the show. Hello, listeners and fans of archaeology. I'm your host for the next hour, Chris Webster. I'm a contract archaeologist in the field we call cultural resources management. I also run the Archaeology Podcast Network, and we have lots of shows about archaeology. You can find them all at www.archpodnet.com. Today I'm talking with some researchers from the University of Alaska about an 1,800-year-old footprint that was found there and what that means. While you're listening, remember that this is first and foremost a call-in show. Call in with your questions at 775-515-4141. That's 775-515-4141. You can also tweet your questions to ArchaeoWebby. You can tweet your questions to ArchaeoWebby, ArchaeoWebby, or at ArcPodNet, ArchPodNet. And I will try to keep on top of those during the show. Again, call in with your questions about anything related to archaeology, history, archaeology on TV, anything you want, and particularly anything about the topic that we are discussing today. So again, 775-515-4141. All right. Well, I am going to try not to disconnect our guest and bring him on today. Jared, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Chris.
All right. So let's just jump right into this thing. First, give us your quick little background. You know, who are you? How are you related to the University of Alaska, and what's your responsibility there?
Sure, yeah. So I'm a PhD candidate, and I adjunct part-time at the University of Alaska Anchorage, then also work as a contract archaeologist for Applied Environmental Research Center up here as well.
Okay, awesome. Well, let's get right into the reason that I became aware of what you guys were doing up there. I was sent a press release from the University of Alaska at Fairbanks. I didn't even know I was on that mailing list, but I'm glad I am. Not sure how I got that, probably because of the Archaeology Podcast Network in some way. But it was highlighting, and we're going to discuss this more broadly, but I want to bring us narrowly down to why we're talking today, and then we'll discuss the broader implications of it. But you guys, on a project, and we'll talk more about where that is and what it is, discovered a footprint among lots of other things. So first, to put this in context, where exactly was this footprint found?
Right. So this footprint was found right off the middle of Swan Point, which is most famous for its 14,200-year-old component that is the only confirmed yektai complex component anywhere in North.
Okay.
And yet the late Pleistocene. And anyways, the site as well has the Tanner Valley between 1890 and 1900. And so the component I was really interested in is about 2,000 years old. And so it has this house pit that we could kind of see in. Mm-hmm. That may be one of the oldest forms of that type of feature we have in the valley. So we wanted to go back there and excavate that. That was going to form the bulk of my dissertation.
Okay. And just as a note here, you're breaking up pretty bad on the cell phone. This is a connection between Alaska and Carson City, Nevada. So hopefully we can solve that throughout the show. Maybe sit closer to a window.
Yeah.
Anyway, so we got that it was obviously up in Alaska, and this is a site for your dissertation. What was going on at the time this was found? Like, you guys there's ongoing excavations up there. I know in the press release that said the site was discovered in 1991. And sorry if you said some of this already, but as I said, the call was breaking up a little bit. But what else is being found in context with this footprint? You mentioned the house pit, but what other kinds of things are being found there?
Sure. Well, I've moved to a better location, so I'm hoping this works out. Like you said, the site was discovered by Dr. Charles Holmes in 1991, and he has been back there excavating almost every year since. quite a long time, which has been pretty cool. I've been out there with him off and on since 2012, and we took a small field school out that was hosted by the University of Alaska Fairbanks. We took 10 undergraduates and another grad student out there, and we began to excavate. And the site's very well stratified, and you could clearly see, once we took off the root mat, you could clearly see the ancient living floor, including the interior of this house pit that we defined as this almost reddish-colored sediment that abruptly changed to this yellowish luss, windblown luss that was all deposited on top of that. So it was really easy to take that yellowish luss off and find that reddish cultural component. And right in the top of there was this little footprint, footprint-like feature, I guess. I was kind of distrustful of it right away because, you know, these are so rare in the archaeological record.
Yeah.
But got pretty excited about it, as you can imagine.
Yeah. What as we're discussing these things, I want to, you know, keep it in mind that we're talking to an audience that may not be familiar with archaeological or geological terms. So luss is a pretty significant layer up in that area and across much of Canada as well, and in northern United States, even in some places. What is luss, and how is that formed, so we can understand what we're talking about here?
Sure. Yeah. So what we're calling luss up here is all wind-blown sediment. So we get a lot of this this dirt that just kind of originates with a bunch of the glaciers in mm-hmm. the Alaska Range, and so it just kind of grinds up all these rocks to fine powder, and then these pretty strong katabatic winds come out of the off the glaciers, out of the mountains, and just distributes this dust all over the central Tanana Valley, and that is our primary source of any kind of sediment deposition. So that just has created several feet of dirt, more or less.
Yeah.
All my geoarchaeology friends would hate me for calling it that. But
right.
So.
All right. And the person who actually was excavating when you guys found the footprint, what kind of excavation method were they using? Were they just digging with a shovel? Were they digging with a trowel, nice and finely? Because I've done a lot of excavation myself, and I'll tell you what, seems like it'd be pretty easy to mow through a footprint if you're using a shovel and not know what you're looking at.
No kidding. Yeah, we were all using trowels at this point. So the person who found it noticed it right away. He was one of my undergrad students. His name was Steve Schoenhair.
Mm-hmm.
And we had an older excavation trench that had been dug through the site as a test back in 2005. So we had reopened that, and I'd shown everyone, I was like, okay, this red dirt layer here, this is where we're going to try to expose it. When you find it, don't dig through it. We're just going to see what sort of artifacts are on top of there, any features and shapes. And so it was really easy to distinguish. So he was slowly traveling through it with his trowel, as you do, and kind of exposing the top of that layer, and he found this depression. So he cleaned it out, and I was watching him as he was doing it. We were all pretty interested in what this little shape might be. Mm-hmm. I was more interested in potential post mold.
Yeah,
that might be associated with the house, which was right nearby, which we did find four or five of those also. Is pretty cool, but this was very, very distinct. With my supervision, he uncovered, took all the miscolored sediment out of that. And we had several different researchers come out over the next few weeks to observe it in situ and or in place, as we say in archaeology.
Yeah, yeah. What was the environment up there at the time? Like, what is the weather doing in Alaska? What did you have to do to preserve this? Once you uncovered it, I mean, it stayed uncovered until I think you made a cast of it, or did you remove the whole thing somehow? Or, you know, what was the weather doing, and how did you guys preserve this as you uncovered it?
Sure. Well, the central Tanana Valley is a lot like the western U.S. As far mm-hmm. as a continental climate. The summers are fairly dry. They get wetter towards August and also in kind of the late spring. Okay. So the temperatures are pretty much the same as well. So we get temperature swings anywhere from 20 degrees in the mornings to 80 degrees in the afternoons, and all kinds of inclement weather with that. Like if you're in Nevada or Montana, so a lot of people don't think about that when they hear Alaska.
Yeah.
But anyways, yeah, that summer we had a pretty hot and dry summer. There was just a couple of small rainstorms that moved through, but nothing too bad. So we were able to leave it uncovered to see how it related to the rest of the features. We protected it with some Visqueen plastic as we needed to and at night. But we immediately were able to take a plaster mold of it within a couple days. But primarily every single day I actually photo modeled it, which is, so I just took about, you know, about 60 photographs, digital photographs around the feature. And then we use various software from Agisoft to create a digital three-dimensional model of that. So we could actually, we can monitor on it on a daily basis to see if there was any sort of taphonomic change. Or, you know, such as erosion or drying out or warping that was occurring. And we never really did get much. We compared them all, and there was maybe a little bit of surface damage, nothing more than a millimeter around the heel area when we actually removed the feature. So we stabilized it with this spray-on foam, sort of like what you would use if you were spraying insulation in an old house or something. Mm-hmm. And remove the entire feature, and it's sitting in our university lab, and eventually it will go to the State Museum, so everyone can see it there.
Okay. What do you think the time frame is on that? I mean, this is a long time to get into a museum, I'm sure.
Yeah, I should be, I'm hoping to finish up my dissertation writing by next spring. So if everything goes well at that point, I'll hand over all these artifacts and the footprint and documentation to the museum. So hopefully within a year.
Yeah. Okay, cool. Well, so. I'm curious, you know, people have 2 feet typically. So, <Yeah. laughs> and you don't mention finding a second one or any other footprints like that on the site. What are your, I mean, if I were out there either excavating or supervising a site like this and somebody found something, I would almost instantly be skeptical of it being a footprint simply because there aren't any others, particularly one right next to it, presumably in similar environmental conditions, similar soil, you know, similar things to create that other footprint that somebody was, you know, presumably standing there. What are your thoughts on that? You know, why maybe there aren't others, or do you think there could be others and you guys just haven't found them yet, or maybe they were, you know, mowed through by less studious excavators?
Right. Well, we were very interested in that. We opened up, we were out there last year as well. So we opened up more in that area, never did find a second footprint, but we found the footprint sits between what looks like 2 cache pits and the house pit, and all of them are within about a 3-foot diameter around the footprint. So the footprint was probably right about on the outer or inner margins of the original house pit walls, where those might have been. And so we threw a bunch of standard forensic tests at this feature to kind of gauge it, what, you know, the body size and maybe an age profile or a gender profile of this individual that might have left the footprint. And so it looks like we have the footprint was excellently preserved. So, sorry, I have a jet flying over me right now. That might be a little loud.
That's all right.
But the footprint was really excellently preserved. We have, you know, a nice ball of the print and heel of the print, and so we were able to get just standard forensic biometrics from it. And it looks like this is about a size maybe 5 to 6 shoe size, U.S. shoe size, and those typically match up with preteen kids from about 9 to 12 years old, something like that.
Sure.
And which was really cool. But it also can match up with women with small feet, for example, or shorter adults of either gender, although statistically it's less likely. Statistically, it's more likely that this is a kid. And right. kids are always, you know, for those of us that have kids or watch kids a lot, you know, they're always walking places and playing in places where adults just aren't going or can't get. And so my best idea, and it's totally speculation here, is that this was probably left by a preteen child who may have been playing somewhere that was hard to get at for adults or any other, you know, sort of trampoline activities, and happened to put a footprint just in the right place next to the house that walls that it got preserved.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, okay. it's all speculation, but that's the best story I could come up with.
Yeah, for sure, for sure. And I like that you said that, you know, statistically, it's not likely to be like a you know, smaller woman or something like that. It's more than likely what you said, because I always tell people on my podcast and on this radio show that when we find stuff in archaeology, we typically have to assume it's not an outlier, because it's really hard to find outliers, right? It's
right.
more common to find more common things, and that just makes sense. That's where I always start from as well, is this must be a representative example of what's out here and what represents biology in that case, and go from there, and then try to disprove that, I guess, with other evidence. So,
yep, exactly.
Yeah. So you mentioned in the it's mentioned in the press release that you guys used carbon dating to determine the age of the footprint. Presumably that's not carbon dating on the footprint, because that's not possible, but carbon dating on some of the other things around, I don't know, immediately at vicinity or just on the site. What did you guys date out there? What were you able to get?
Right. Yeah. It's unfortunate that the person didn't leave their shoe in the for us to get a direct date on. But so we took a suite of radiocarbon assays across from the house. We could see the remnants of burned timber structures, which had probably been used to create the semi-subterranean house. And there was also some ephemeral evidence of two hearths inside the house pit as well. And all of those dated right around 1900 years ago, which is... in real time years, calendar years, is about 1840 years ago. So that's what the house pit dated. But then we also took several assays from the two cache pits that were also on either side of the footprint. And that complicated the process, as everything always does when you add more data. But one of the cache pits was about 600 years older than the house pit. And the other cache pit was about 1,000 years older than the house pit. So it could be, the footprint could be as old as 3,600 years ago, or it could be as young as the house pit, which is about 1,840 calibrated years. And I think it's most likely associated with the younger dates, as far as, you know, being preserved on the surface there. Yeah.
Yeah. Nice. Nice. Okay. I assume nothing like this has been found in that area before, and I guess I don't know what I mean by area, you know, the Alaskan,
right.
you know, area like that. I mean, is there any comparable things you can look at?
Yeah, so this is the first human footprint that we've found anywhere in Alaska mm-hmm. and anywhere in the North American subarctic for that reason. The closest footprints are down on Calvert Island, which are those 14,000-year-old footprints along the beach.
Mm-hmm.
Beach site there, which have gotten pretty famous. They were discovered right about the same time.
Mm-hmm.
It was pretty cool. So we compared them with those. We also compared them with the footprints from that sloth hunt in White Sands, New Mexico, which are about also, I think, 14,000, 13,000 years old, if I remember right.
Okay.
But our best comparison data set came from Jaguar Cave in Tennessee, and Patty Jo Watson and a bunch of colleagues measured a human trackway in there that I think it was about 4,000 years old. It looked like several groups of teenagers at two different time periods walked through on a clay floor inside this cave, probably exploring, and they had left some torches in the floor there. But their footprints were perfectly preserved, and they were all barefoot individuals. So we compared our footprint metrics against the footprint metrics that they had taken on. I think they had like 200 footprints in that cave,
mm-hmm.
which was a pretty
wow.
cool study. We also compared ours against a bunch of prehistoric moccasins, moccasin sizes that had found. It was somewhere in the Great Basin with John Ives and one of his students had published a paper, and now I can't remember the citation off the top of my head.
Yeah.
But we compared it against those as well, and everything came back pretty standard, that this was, you know, matched most closely with a preteen individual, and what didn't seem to be, you know, the width of the footprint or the length or the length of it or the length of the heel didn't, nothing was an outlier against anything that we were comparing it to. But yeah, there's not very many published footprint sites in the Americas that actually includes all these forensic measurements on them. Most people just say, you know, when they publish a footprint paper, they'll say, this looks like a footprint there, therefore it is, but they don't include very many measurements with it. So it gets a little, it got a little frustrating trying to find a comparison comparative data set.
Nice. Yeah. Okay.
Chris Webster here for the Archaeology Podcast Network. We strive for high quality interviews and content so you can find information on any topic in archaeology from around the world. One way we do that is by recording interviews with our hosts and guests located in many parts of the world all at once. We do that through the use of Zencastr. That's Z-E-N-C-A-S-T-R. Zencastr allows us to record high quality audio with no stress on the guest. Just send them a link to click on and that's it. Zencastr does the rest. They even do automatic transcriptions. Check out the link in the show notes for 30% off your first 3 months, or go to zencastr.com and use the code TAS. Looking to expand your knowledge of x-rays and imaging in the archaeology field? Then check out An Introduction to Paleoradiography, a short online course offering professional training for archaeologists and affiliated disciplines. Created by archaeologist, radiographer, and lecturer James Elliott, the content of this course is based upon his research and teaching experience in higher education. It is approved by the Chartered Institute for Archaeologists as 4 hours of training. That's in the UK, for those of you that don't know. So don't miss out on this exciting opportunity for professional and personal development. For more information on pricing and course structure, visit paleoimaging.com. That's P-A-L-E-O imaging.com. And look for the link in the show notes to this episode.
All right. So question, because you mentioned before when we were talking about the print itself, you know, it's unfortunate that they didn't leave a shoe behind. Could you tell from the imprint, I would assume you can, whether or not the person was actually wearing a shoe or were they barefoot?
It looks very similar to a soft-soled shoe. I don't think they were barefoot. We couldn't really see clear, you know, toe prints or anything like that. It just sort of looked like what you might expect from a moccasin print in very soft sediment.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Now stand by. I don't have anybody answering the phones for me, so I'm going to answer this call and see if it's for this show. This is Chris on KMBC. What can we do for you?
I have a question.
Yeah, go ahead.
I want to know, how does the age of this footprint affect history formerly from the area, and has it changed anything of how far back in history they go? And once again, the what was the age of the footprint, and why were they digging in that place? You know, when the guy was cutting out at the beginning of the show, I think I missed what their purpose for digging there was.
Okay.
Okay.
All right. I'm going to switch back to the other call, and I think I'll drop you at the same time. So I'm going to ask you your call after the air.
Okay, bye.
All right. Jared, did you hear that?
Yes, I did.
Okay. So, yeah, I mean, we answered it's 1,800 years old. I think we were breaking up a little bit at that point. But, yeah, what does this mean for the, you know, how does this impact the archaeology of the area?
Sure. Well, the footprint itself doesn't really have any impact. It just looks like an average child's footprint. We've known people were there for 14,000 years. The association of it with this house pit is really cool. The house pit is one of the oldest houses, semi-subterranean houses that we have in the Tanana Valley. And so we're using that as a proxy for early Dene or Athabascan migrations into this area, which is kind of cool. It has a lot of information, probably, you know, important to Navajo and Apache migrations into the south as well. But the footprint itself, it seems to really strike a note with people. People just, you know, they see footprints and they feel a more personal connection I think they do than to other artifacts or features in the record. I've noticed when I talk to a lot of the local native groups in the area, and we're planning on taking the feature on tour to several of the villages up and down the Tanana River when we're done with the study. And these groups, the elders and the other families that live in these villages, are really excited to see that. Most of them feel this connection. You know, they can actually see something, a direct connection with their ancestors that doesn't involve, you know, like a dead body.
Sure.
I hate to use those words.
But, yeah.
You know, that's almost what it's the closest analog without having a corpse or someone's clothes or something like that. So it's really cool because you can see the direct imprint of someone as they were just going around in their average everyday life.
Yeah. And I the caller's other question was it possibly answered during the first part of this interview. However, I think that was when the cell phone was breaking up a little bit. But how was this site originally discovered? Like, why were people there? How did you know about it?
Sure. Yeah. So the site's on an isolated hill
in
this area called the Shaw Creek Flats, the Shaw Creek Valley. It's right in the middle of the Tanana Valley, west of Fairbanks, about an hour and a half drive.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a group of people were excavating the Broken Mammoth site, which is an important terminal Pleistocene site for Alaska. And they wanted to explore this isolated hill that they saw out there. It looked just really, really likely that it was going to have some human remains or artifact remains on it, stuff like that. So a small team went out there and sunk the shovel test pit into the hill and immediately started finding artifacts and got down deep, and they found some very old artifacts. So it looks like now that there was people 14,000 years ago had a little ivory, mammoth ivory workshop going on the site. And so that is probably what the site is most famous for, is that really old component. And that's what most of the publications have been on. So I'm focusing on the younger components, the stuff that's, that we have a component that is historic native about 100 years ago, and then another component that's about 800 years old, and then this component that I'm focusing on is about 2,000 years old. So,
is there any evidence that the site was continuously occupied for, I mean, presumably close to 2,000 years, or was it kind of a seasonal thing? People just kept coming back there? Is there any way to tell that right now?
It's probably a seasonal thing.
Yeah.
We definitely see some animal remains being brought into there. It looks like people were creating tools or retooling their hunting weaponry on the site. It doesn't look like we have very many butchery habits for the middle Holocene, that late Holocene component that I'm analyzing. That may have happened somewhere off-site, somewhere nearby. But we don't see a lot of stuff being brought into the site, although it must have since there was a house there. But what's really interesting about that is it seems like the people that lived in that house pit were kept a very, very clean site. So a lot of the artifacts, the only artifacts we find are very tiny, and it seems like people just kind of tried to clean it up. They cleaned out their hearths. They burned all their bones. And these behaviors are really consistent with historic anthropologists noted with the Tanana Valley Dene people 100 years ago. It's really consistent with their beliefs about keeping a pure site, a pure household, a clean household. So
okay.
Pretty convinced that this is we're seeing some ancestral behaviors to that at this site, which is kind of neat.
Well, given that they kept themselves so clean, that must make it hard to do archaeology and find other things.
It really is. And I think without that cultural analog, without knowing that, you'd probably be very disappointed or very confused as an archaeologist trying to interpret what's going on there. But it's really cool to be able to think about how those beliefs and those cultural identities are likely affecting the archaeological record there.
Mm-hmm. Was there any sort of, I guess, for lack of a better word, trash area or something like that for like broken pottery and other things, or do they just reuse a lot of what they had and burn everything else?
We haven't found it yet, if there is.
Yeah.
So I'm not sure.
Okay.
I have looked. So,
okay.
There's another locus up near the top of the hill where most of the late Pleistocene stuff was found. We do have a lot of debitage and unburned faunal remains up there, so that might have been an area that they weren't as concerned about being clean and pure as they were their living area down at the house pit.
Right, right. Okay. Now, what does having this young, healthy child mean for the people that lived there? What does it tell you about the people that lived there, at least when the footprint was created, about the family or family group or whatever you would call it that lived there?
Sure, yeah. So we were able to get an idea of the body mass of this child, which you can make pretty good estimates based on the depth of the footprint and the width of the ball of the foot, which can increase or decrease depending on, you know, your body mass or your heavy load that you might be carrying. And so this person looked like an average weight for a 9 to 12 year old kid. And so that tells me that this was a person who, you know, wasn't starving, at least during this season, which could always happen for sedentary peoples. So a person who's not starving is probably fairly happy. It's being cared for by parents. We can't tell the gender on this person. So I hope they treated, you know, all their kids just as well, regardless of gender back then.
Right.
But, so we'll assume they do. Right. Right. But this, you know, I see that and I get a sense of happiness, a sense of contentment when I see a person being treated that way. Just down the valley, we have the Upward Sun River site where the remains of three children were found in burial context that were about 12,000 years old, 11,600 years old was burials. And those ones, that's kind of a sad sight because we have, you know, three individuals that were right about, you know, the time of birth, a little bit before, a little bit after, that all died. And obviously, that would have been a very sad experience for the family that had to bury those individuals. And so this is a nice contrast to that. Here we have, you know, footprint left by a child, behind by a child who, you know, based on their body weight, was living a pretty content life. And I can't really say much more than that, other than they lived in a house that took quite a lot of energy to create.
Mm-hmm.
So that probably means they had plenty of resources at hand. They were feeling fairly content having to live there and not have to move around the landscape a lot. So I think everybody was just, you know, this is a site where you just have good feelings about, and you can probably accurately infer good feelings were happening there 2,000 years ago.
Okay. That just reminded me of a kind of a side question I was thinking of earlier. How big is the house, the typical house there? I've seen different things in like the plains and, you know, like you get over to Washington and you get like long houses and things like that. What did a typical house for this kind of family look like in Alaska?
Sure. Well, I can't speculate on what it looked like, but
sure.
Based on the footprint of this house, not the footprint of the kid, but the feature of the house, it probably could have fit a small family in there fairly comfortably, at least for sleeping and maybe doing a few minor activities inside the house. It was probably, the pit itself is about 8 feet long, and so it might have had maybe a dome-shaped structure, tent structure over the top of it that would have been a bit longer, maybe 10 feet or something like that. So I guess if you think of taking a family out camping and they have, you know, a 10-foot-long tent that maybe you could stand up inside of, that's a good analog. Something like that. So probably most activities happened outside the house, and people just used it for meeting, sleeping, and eating and staying warm.
Sure, sure. Why, you've kind of alluded to this a little bit, but why was this footprint so important to the site and to archaeology in that area as a whole? And I'm asking this because, you know, the footprint itself, it's not an artifact. It confirms that we knew people were there, but the other stuff you found – you know, did that as well. And you mentioned, you know, the health of the family and things like that. But is there a broader implication? I mean, you didn't send out the University of Alaska didn't send out a press release because you found a house pit. They sent out a press release because you found a footprint. And now this is bringing the archaeology of the area to a wider audience, to the world in general. You know, presumably they sent it out all over the place, and now we're talking about it on the radio. So, you know, to you, what does this footprint mean to all that? You know what I mean?
Right. Well, it is very unique, and I might have mentioned this earlier. It's the only one we've ever found anywhere in Alaska, so it's kind of a one-of-a-kind discovery in and of itself. And, you know, as archaeologists, we always hate the question that we get asked all the time, what's your favorite thing you've ever found? Because that tends to be what the general public thinks of archaeology. We're out, you know, like in the 19th century, just out finding things,
right,
and taking them to museums. And so this was something we found and we get to take to a museum. And so I think that's really struck a chord with a lot of the general public, being able to do that. We can infer behaviors, you know, from it, which is pretty cool from an academic sense. But there is something, you know, it's all speculation, but there's something about a footprint that resonates with people. And sometimes I tie it back to my own background. I grew up in an evangelical Christian household, and it seems like when I remember being a kid, everyone that my parents were friends with, everyone had this poem that was on a plaque on their wall called Footprints in the Sand, I think it was. And it's about this dream that this man has when he's looking back on his life. He's walking hand in hand with Jesus down a beach, and his whole life is just an analog in these footprints in the sand. And so sometimes that obviously had resonated with a lot of people. And I think almost everybody in our culture has probably seen that at least one time in their life. And so there's something about footprints that really resonates with us as a species, I guess, because I get hits on this paper from all over the world, and people leave comments just saying how cool it is that this happened and stuff like that. So there's something in about it being a footprint that is so unique and just touches a lot of people on a subconscious level, I think.
Yeah, it really connects you almost more than more than human remains, to be honest, because human remains they've been left there. They didn't put themselves there. Other people did. And this is somebody living their life. I had a chance to see the segment of the Laetoli trackway out in Africa that they brought to the Leakey camp in Olduvai Gorge. I spent 3 weeks at the Leakey camp it was back in 2005 or something. And, I mean, that was amazing. These are, what were they? Almost 2 million-year-old footprints left in the Laetoli trackway. And it was just, it's kind of amazing thinking about that they were even preserved for that long, and thinking that people are just walking, probably walking really fast, getting away from that volcano that's looking pretty bad right now, and continuing to move. And like you said, the footprint you found is a little bit happier situation because it seems like it's a healthy, individual, healthy site. They got plenty of food. Weather's not so bad, I guess. Probably they're used to it. So that's pretty cool. I like that. And, obviously I get the question too, what's the coolest thing you've ever found? Things like that. And I hate to bring up things because things tell a story, and I like to tell the story instead. And the footprint really, it's kind of a thing, but it also tells a story.
Yeah.
It's really neat. Exactly. You'll be able to say that one for a long time.
I know. I might have hit the pinnacle of my career too early.
Time to retire. There you go. So what about broader implications for the region? If you've got a healthy family living right here, does this change any interpretations of any other sites in the area that you may have done in research leading up to this?
Well, yeah. We're really interested. The reason I'm looking at this time period is we're really interested in trying to identify early Dene migration behaviors. So we're trying to figure out where did the Dene people or Athabascan people, not Dene, depending on what paradigm you're coming from, where did they originate? Where did they come from? And we have about 1,000 years ago, we had this volcano on the border of Alaska and the Yukon Territory explode into this massive eruption sent ash all over North America. I think some of it ended up falling in Greenland and Iceland and caused a couple of cold years across Europe during that time. But it seems to have, we really see sort of a regional change in the expression of artifacts. Artifacts kind of change. They go out. We have a lot of stories, sort of ethnogenesis stories with different Dene tribes across northern Canada that talk about migrations that were spurred in relation to a volcanic-like event. There's pretty good. We have a pretty good idea that that may have spurred the ancestors of the Navajo and Apache languages to leave northern Canada and begin their migration down into the southwest. And so, but nobody's really been able to sort of identify how that affected Alaska. So we're to the east of that whole volcanic event. So there's two different volcanic events, one that occurred about 1,600 years ago from the same volcano, and one that occurred about 1,000 years ago. So I'm looking at this site, an important house pit site that's just prior to both volcanic events. And then we're also, I took another field school out this last month, and I just got back from it from a couple days ago. And we were looking at another house pit that dates to just after, maybe 100 years after that last big volcanic event. And so we're comparing those two house pit sites to see, are there very many changes between them? Can we see any sort of indication of the house pit construction styles changing? What that might say, and maybe correlate that with the volcanoes that were popping off just to the west. And there are some interesting differences. The Swan Point house pit, which is just slightly older than both volcanic events, you could fit a small family inside that house pit, but again, they were, you know, living semi-sedentary lifestyle. Maybe they were just using the house during the winter and camping around during the summer. But this house pit that we found that's just about 5 miles, river miles up the road, that dates to just after both volcanic events, you could definitely comfortably fit about three families in there. And so, and that's something that's much more similar to what we know of the historic Tanana Valley Athabascan people that were there. They lived in this matrilocal society where the villages were sort of organized through related sisters and their brothers. So we call it an avunculocal matricib sociopolitical society. To throw some academic words in there.
Yeah.
But so we do see some sort of change, and that is probably being affected by out-migrations coming from the Yukon. And maybe they're bringing the same people, probably just changing their socio-political system to adapt to new people coming into the region. Anyways, that's an interesting story. So we'll see if that plays out or not.
Okay.
You may have heard my pitch for membership. It's a great idea and really helps out. However, you can also support us by picking up a fun t-shirt, sticker, or something from a large selection of items from our Tee Public store. Head over to arcpodnet.com/shop for a link. That's arcpodnet.com/shop to pick up some fun swag and support the show.
Jared, one thing I was thinking about when you were talking about the site that is, you know, post-volcanic eruption and the site that is pre-volcanic eruption is a question I'd be interested in asking is, How did the volcano, even if the volcano didn't environmentally disrupt them too much, like maybe all the, you know, the ash blew the other direction or something, it still would have been a pretty significant spiritual event, more than likely, because you don't see a volcanic eruption like that every day, and maybe once in your lifetime, unless it was really active up there. But I wonder if that would have changed how they see other people, maybe want to come together a little bit more and come into these bigger houses and you know, maybe have that focus on the family a little more, because I don't know, life is so fleeting. And remember back 3 generations ago when this whole thing happened and half the people died or something like that. I wonder if that would have affected how they thought and how you could even figure that out in the archaeological record, for one thing.
Yeah, I think you're onto something there. I think that, you know, if it really indeed spurred a bunch of out migrations, you know, a volcano comes, you know, blows up and all your food resources are gone for 10 years or something like that, everyone has to leave, right? And so where do you go? You end up moving into the territories that are closest to you. And if you have relatives in those territories that you're in good with, you know, your life isn't going to be so difficult. But if you don't have relatives, your life is going to be probably a lot more difficult, and they may even be hostile to your presence in their, you know, resource gathering grounds. And really this, matricide socio-political system where everyone was related through their mothers, and you knew all your extended relations out for, you know, third cousins and fourth cousins, as we would say in our, you know, familial system. If you knew how you were related to everybody, you would know who you could go and ask for favors, such as, you know, staying at their house, using their caribou, or salmon fishing grounds, and stuff like that. So you'd be much more likely to survive. And I think if there was any people on the landscape that had a different sort of socio-political system, they were probably less likely to survive, or they simply married into these much more successful social systems, you know, during a time of stress like that. So yeah. I think that that's a really important point of ethnogenesis for that dual social system that we see during that time that sort of arises in across Northern America. And that sort of system gives rise to a dual society where half the people are in your village are related to one moiety, which a moiety is just an extended family that you inherit through your mother's side. Mm-hmm. And the other half is related to the other side. So it's two sides, and you're only allowed to marry across members of the opposite side, the opposite clan or super clan. And so the super clans are they're set up in a way that the people of the opposite clan are always your economic adversaries and political adversaries. You're always sort of struggling with them for gain of resources and competition and stuff. But then also they're the only ones that can throw you a funeral. Then they're the only ones that you can marry into. So it's very similar to our own socio-political system that we have, you know, between conservatives and liberals. We look at the other system you know, or the other side, and we say those are our adversaries, those are our economic enemies, and we need to, you know, we're constantly struggling with them. But I think their society was a little bit more closely bound than ours because, you know, that's not we don't have any safeguards in our society that ties us to that other side. Mm-hmm. Where we benefit from that, we're just in perpetual competition.
Yeah.
And so I really look at the social system, and I see a lot of benefits that I think our own current political system could learn a lot from.
Yeah, indeed. So I'm curious, just as a couple last questions here as we're closing out the hour. You mentioned that the family that would have lived, at least at the time of the child that left the footprint, a mostly sedentary lifestyle. Just to kind of paint that picture a little bit more, were they doing any agriculture in that area, or was it mostly just hunting and gathering?
Mostly hunting and gathering, but there was a little bit of, I don't know, I guess we could call it pre-agriculture. People were definitely creating or maintaining fish ponds. So they would dam up ponds during the spring melt-off, and catch fish in these little ponds, and then let them grow a lot or really fat over the summer, and then loosen those dams in the winter and harvest the fish that were coming out. They were also cultivating trees along these enormous caribou and moose fences that would sometimes go for almost, you know, 20 to 80 miles across the landscape.
Wow.
And spruce trees, they grow for hundreds of years. They grow very slow up here in Alaska. And so to see tree cultivation last generations like that is pretty cool. So there was a little bit of, I guess, what we could call agricultural behaviors happening, but definitely a mix between the two.
Yeah. Man, I mean, I've seen game fences down here in Nevada, but and for those of the listeners that don't know what we're talking about, basically just something to guide game into some sort of area where they can either be killed or, you know, corralled into an area that's easier for them to catch. But how the heck high does a fence need to be to keep a moose from jumping over it or even a caribou?
Well, I guess about 10 feet, 5 to 10 feet. So
that's a lot of resources.
They would also, hide snares inside these to catch the animals by their antlers or necks and make them easier to kill.
Yeah.
As well. But, okay. All kinds.
Nice. Man, I can't imagine the labor involved in putting something like that together. So,
no kidding.
Yeah. Another indication that people were there and invested in that one particular area for longer periods of time. They wouldn't put something like that together if they weren't planning on sticking around for multiple generations.
Exactly.
So,
yep.
All right. Well, what's next for this site in particular? You just finished the field season. Is there anything you can report on there or what you guys are going to do next year maybe?
At the moment, we're closing up excavations at Swan Point. Our current contract with the state is up after this year, so now I just got to write it all up and hopefully have some really cool other articles that pop out of the site. So.
Yeah. Okay. Beyond that, what's next for you? Well, I guess before I get to there, your dissertation is on this site, but most people, often you have very specific questions in your dissertation. Did this footprint come in line with that or just spur a whole bunch of new questions?
It sort of did. I was really hoping to take a traditional four field approach to my anthropology approach to mm-hmm. my dissertation. So I wanted there to be an archaeology component, a cultural anthropology component, a linguistic component, which I'm doing by analyzing the traditional place names in the area. And I wanted a bioarchaeology or bioanthropology component as well. But at the time when I wrote up my prospectus, I didn't have any idea of what that would be. And then lo and behold, a footprint just appeared on the site. So it just kind of was like, oh, cool, I will get to talk a little bit about biological anthropology here. So that was just kind of a fun thing that accidentally happened. Chaos theory in the mix.
Nice. Well, when you get your dissertation all finished and you're all done with this thing, what's next for you? What are you looking forward to on the horizon?
I really want to continue on an academic role. I love research projects and I love teaching as well. Mm-hmm. I'm having a lot of fun with these field schools, bringing in students to learn, how to do archaeology. I also try to bring in a lot of lay people around from the area to see these sites, especially the local native communities. I try to bring out representatives whenever I can. And also when we're in the lab analyzing the remains and putting together the story. So I'm hoping to continue on an academic track afterwards. But archaeologists, we all know that's pretty hard to do. There's only a limited number of jobs out there. So I'm keeping my options open at this point. We'll see what opens up.
Right. Speaking of, you're probably willing to go just about anywhere that will hire you, like most archaeologists. However, do you want to keep on in Alaska and keep answering those questions up there? Does that fit with your, idea of what you wanted to be when you said, I want to be an archaeologist? Or is there something else you'd rather be studying a little more?
Yeah, I definitely really enjoy Alaska. Mm-hmm. Really unique place. I've also worked down in the Northern Great Basin in Yellowstone Park and also in Hawaii. And, archaeology is archaeology everywhere. It's really cool. It's really unique to the region. And I enjoy it wherever I end up in the world. And it's really fun career to be able to travel with and experience new places. So I could go elsewhere. I have about 10 years of experience in the state, and it would be sort of a bummer to leave all that local experience behind and start out anew somewhere else. So, but you got to do what you got to do.
Yeah, indeed. Well, I'm sure there's going to be a lot that comes out of this research as well. It sounds like it was a fascinating site, and you've got a lot more you want to write about it. Do you think you'll do anything that highlights, a story around this footprint, or has that become a part of the larger picture now and you're going to move on from there?
I am thinking about trying to do a little creative writing piece based on it. I'm much more adept at academic writing or report writing for CRM projects, but I would like to be able to write this up, maybe for Archaeology Magazine or something like that, and try to get it out to a general lay audience.
Mm-hmm.
I think that would be, that's so important. archaeology is science, and science is nothing if it's not, you know, shared with everybody out there.
Yeah.
So I really would like to get this story out to a local audience and or a lay audience. And I appreciate this opportunity to talk with your podcast and your radio station and be able to get that to the audience down there in Nevada.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, when this goes out on the podcast, you know, we have a worldwide audience as well, and this will be out in August on the podcast for anybody that wants to hear this again. So it's my goal as well to just get as much of this information out to a lay audience and people that are interested as possible. So I thank you very much for coming on. And as far as doing some sort of creative writing piece, I'll tell you what, when I read Brian Fagan's Before California book, the thing that always sticks with me is he starts every chapter with a really almost fanciful representation of what he's about to talk about, you know, some site or something like that. But it takes you back in time to the time period of that site and makes a fictional piece, but based on evidence of the people that live there and what they were doing. And that was just a really cool aspect of that book. I can't say I remember a whole lot else about the rest of it, but that really stuck with me, you know, yeah. Years after reading it.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, that's cool. Yeah, Brian Fagan's an excellent writer.
Yeah, I love it. I love it. So, all right. Well, we will say goodbye. Thank you, Jared, for coming on, and hopefully we can bring you on again when you know, you guys find some other stuff, or you know, maybe some other time when you're doing some other cool things. So definitely hit us up for that.
Great. Thank you very much, Chris.
All right. Thank you. And we're gonna wrap up this show right now. Thanks again, Jared.
All right. Take care.
You too. All right, so that's it for the show this week. Tune in next time. I'm not sure who we have on next week. I've got to look at the calendar. But in July, I will be off for 2 weeks, and I'll have some recorded presentations from the Archaeology Podcast Network and the Archaeology Show podcast. And you're actually going to hear one of them here first before it goes out on the podcast, which is pretty great. A lot of times when I'm gone, I'll take those podcast recordings and I will package them up and bring them over here. But these aren't scheduled to go out for a while, so they're going to come out here first. One of them is with Monica Smith, and we talk about some really cool stuff. She has a book called Cities, the First 6,000 Years that she sent us a copy of, and I got to recommend checking that out because it was a really great book. Really nice discussion with myself and my co-host April about cities and the development of cities and all those sorts of things. And then we had another discussion with Michelle Coons, who's the curator of archaeology at the Denver Museum of Nature and Science. And we talked a lot about just what's going on there, some of the public archaeology and public outreach things that they have, this thing called the Magic Mountain Community Archaeology Project, and a whole bunch of other stuff. So check that out over at archpodnet.com, archpodnet.com. And right there on the front page, you can click on a show that interests you and then see the latest episodes from there. And you can play them right from the page as well. You can also find our podcast anywhere that you listen to podcasts. We're on a new platform now that changes our advertising dynamic a little bit, so that's pretty cool. But definitely check that out. So anyway, this has been Chris Webster with the Archaeology Podcast Network and KNVC Community Radio. That's KNVC 95.1 FM, Carson Community Media, and we're located in Carson City, Nevada, and online at knvc.org/listen-live. Next time you're on, please use the call-in line. You can always tweet me a question, Archaeowebby, ArchEowebby, or at ArcPodNet. And that's it for this week. We'll see you next time. Thanks for listening to the Archaeology Podcast. We hope you enjoyed it. You can provide feedback using the contact button on the right side of the website at www.archaeologypodcastnetwork.com/archaeology. Or you can email Chris at archaeologypodcastnetwork.com. Please like and share the show wherever you saw it so more people can have a chance to listen and learn. Send us show suggestions and follow ArcPodNet on Twitter and Instagram. This show is produced by the Archaeology Podcast Network. Opinions are solely those of the hosts and guests of the show. However, the APN stands by their hosts. Special thanks to the band Sea Hero for letting us use their song, I Wish You'd Look. Check out their albums on Bandcamp at seahero.bandcamp.com. Check out our next episode in 2 weeks, and in the meantime, keep learning, keep discovering new things, and keep listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network. Have an awesome day.
This show is produced and recorded by the Archaeology Podcast Network, Chris Webster and Tristan Boyle, in Reno, Nevada, at the Reno Collective.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.
Thanks again for listening to this episode and for supporting the Archaeology Podcast Network. If you want these shows to keep going, consider becoming a member for just $7.99 US dollars a month. That's cheaper than a venti quad eggnog latte. Go to archpodnet.com/members for more info.